I am a pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, which is not the ELCA north of the border. It is the ELCIC. And for this evening, I'd like to say a little about my journey that led me to go to El Salvador. And I'd like to hear a little about your own journeys also and what led you to whatever level of interest you have in El Salvador, what brings you here this evening. I should begin by saying that I'm not all here, I'm only half here, and that's not so unusual in itself, except that I plan to have a partner here with me named Balmoria Maya, who is a Salvadoran who works with the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. And rather than being here, he is waiting in Canada because he could not get a visitor's visa to enter the U.S. We tried all we could, both from El Salvador and then from Vancouver over the last few weeks. And we had a lot of good help from the ELCA, from Dennis Fredo in Washington, who sent many faxes to the consulate in Vancouver, ensuring them that the ELCA was backing Balmori and that, we had a letter of invitation from Holy Village, of course, to begin with. That was not adequate. And the ELCA's word for his promise of departure was not adequate either, nor was the invitation from the Canadian National Bishop Schoberg. They were concerned that once he would come to the U.S., he would not leave, so they felt it was better not to let him come in at all. So I'm disappointed. He's very disappointed. He was very much looking forward to being here this week. And he is an artist and a dancer and a dramatist and a poet, and he would have had a lot to contribute this week. He has been in Canada for a month and doing that kind of thing, both at the worship conference in Calgary, a national event, about a month ago, and then more recently in Vancouver at the National Youth Gathering. So we were doing some dance, and he did a lot of artwork for that event. Ow. I always feel uncomfortable talking about El Salvador without Salvadorans present. Whenever I try to, as I've been traveling across Canada, I always try and link up with whatever local groups of refugees are there, and there usually are significant numbers in even the small towns across Canada. And so I always try and involve their participation whenever possible, to give some element of the culture, of the reality, of the level of, or the spirit of celebration and hope, in spite of all the pain they've suffered. And also to keep me honest and credible, and so on too. So it's unfortunate that there are no Salvadorans here, and that Balmori can't be here. My journey to El Salvador actually began perhaps 10 years ago, but in a very roundabout way. And I grew up in the Lutheran Church in a Lutheran clergy family with, I guess, the theology that Dan Erlander was talking about this morning, if any of you were in that session, about Jesus dying for our sins to ensure that we obtain salvation. And I guess I wasn't very much aware of the rest of the world or aware of the Lutheran Church in other parts of the world. I've heard some through missionaries and their slides and so on, but my real exposure, my eye-opening experience was through a group of Nigerian singers who came to Canada in the summer of 1980. And that summer I had been asked to chauffeur and host this group from Nigeria. I'm not sure why I was asked, but it seemed intriguing and appealing, and I accepted. And so I spent 10 weeks almost as a Nigerian looking at Canada through rather different eyes, and asking rather different questions. And their questions were ones like, why are there no Native Indian people in the Lutheran Church in Canada? Because they knew probably more about Native Indian culture in Canada than Canadians do. And they were very surprised to spend 10 weeks in Canada and not meet any in the churches. They were wondering about the level of waste, especially when we eat in restaurants or stay at universities, all the packaged stuff that would get thrown away, and keeping platefuls that people could not finish. And so all this food that was dumped. They were wondering how we could tolerate that level of waste. They were a very lively group. They were invited actually by our national youth organization in the Lutheran Church in Canada. And so they spent 10 weeks touring conventions and churches, church camps, and so on. So that really sparked my interest for some more international experience myself, and it gave me opportunity to get to some events, some of the Lutheran World Federation. A seminary tour which took us to the Middle East for a few weeks, and then a Lutheran World, or a Lutheran Student Movement and Lutheran World Federation joint project to Zimbabwe in the summer of 1983. And that was a work-study project. We were there living on, well, there were 25 students from all around North America who participated in this. And we were living with refugees who had returned to Zimbabwe after being exiled to Botswana, Zambia, Malawi, and so on during the 70s when Zimbabwe, when Rhodesia at that time was in the midst of civil war. So they had returned in the early 80s and were resettling in their home country. And so we lived with a cooperative group on a cooperative farm that was sponsored by the LWF, Lutheran World Federation. And that was for a couple of months. Weekends we would go into the capital of Harare and meet with church leaders and government leaders and have more of the educational, get a broader perspective on what was happening in the country and the history of the involvement of the church in the country and cooperation with the government and so on. To see a little of how socialism and the church and the church could work together in rebuilding a society. Coming back from that, I felt, well, I had many opportunities to speak about the experience and to show slides and so on, but I felt that the best part of the experience for me had been the first-hand experience, the encounter with the people, living on site, eating their food, sharing their lifestyle, and so on. And I felt that the best I could offer to others would be to provide a similar kind of experience for others. And so I began exploring the possibilities of organizing a travel seminar. Zimbabwe seemed very remote, both politically, geographically. It was expensive to bring people there, so I started thinking about perhaps Central America. And I was aware of Augsburg College. Of course, Dan Spencer worked there and has over the years. And so I checked with them about the possibility of organizing a tour for a Canadian delegation, and received a lot of support from them. So the tour was in Augsburg, a Center for Global Education and Development, as it was called then. And so we had a huge group, 23 or 4. Traveling for 2 weeks in Mexico, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. And that was in the summer of 85. It worked very well, so I did the same thing again for the summer of 87. Both these groups involved also participants from the US and all across Canada, and from a whole variety of denominational church backgrounds and some non-church backgrounds as well. So quite diverse groups. And so really those experiences were exposure to me to Central America. Between the two, I moved to a parish in Calgary and began to be involved with refugees, most of whom were Central American, and most of the Central Americans were Salvadoran. So I got to be more and more involved with their work, with their organizations in Calgary. And then my visits to the countries, particularly El Salvador, where I was really intrigued with the way the Lutheran Church was working in the midst of civil war and crisis and exploitation and the whole scene there, drew me more and more to living and working there among the people and learning from them. So when I came back in 87, I began to see the possibility of working there as a full-time pastor. I checked with Bishop Medardo Gomez, and he said it would certainly be good for them. They felt if I, as a Canadian, could come down, it would be better for them and for me if I had the backing of a national church, of our national Lutheran church. And so I came back and began working that out. Many advised me that I shouldn't get my hopes up too high because we had just gone through the merger. We have no partnership relationship between the church in Canada and that in El Salvador. And it wasn't likely, people felt, that the church, just after merger, was about to begin with a new partnership, especially to a place which was so unstable. And there was no budgeting for it. But all the way through, when I first spoke with the executive director, and he spoke with the executive committee, of which Beth Lang Christensen from Edmonton was a member, and also Randy Farrell, who's father of Katie Farrell, who's working, or just started on staff here. So they and the others on the committee were very supportive right from the start and made it possible for me to go to El Salvador in 88. I know many U.S. people, and particularly U.S. Lutherans, have sort of made that pilgrimage and gotten involved in El Salvador. But for a Canadian, it was something a bit unique because, I guess, awareness in Canada about Salvador, at least on the level of the church and the church's role in El Salvador, is lower. So I felt my primary role, my primary calling to be in El Salvador, to be one of a reverse missionary, to live and learn among the Salvadorans and then come back with my experiences to Canada and share those, particularly with the churches and beyond, wherever there would be an audience. And so that understanding of mission was a little different for our church also. They worked with the model of, you go for 3 years and then come back on furlough and do a stint. And I felt it would be more important to spend more time back in Canada, at least every year, sharing the stories of El Salvador and helping Canadians understand how the church can function in the midst of such a troubled society and what that would mean for our church in Canada as well. And so that idea gradually caught on, and I did that by also by writing newsletters and articles from El Salvador and meeting with delegations and visitors that came to El Salvador. And my presence there also helps to bring more Canadians down than would otherwise visit. And so I'd anticipated being back in Canada a month or two of each year to speak and travel and tell the stories. As it turned out, I've been doing just that for almost a year now, since I was detained and expelled last November during the offensive. There were six U.S. citizens expelled at the same time, four Germans, one Spanish person as well. And the level of publicity around that event in Canada was something I think you probably wouldn't imagine in the U.S. At least that's the sense I got from talking with people in New York and Chicago. It's, I guess partly because the media were there covering the offensive, there were a lot of Canadian journalists on site, and another Canadian, a woman working with Peace Brigades International, was arrested and expelled just a few days later, a woman from Winnipeg. And so when the two of us got back to Canada, it was fairly high profile in the media, and over the next few months I spoke with upwards of 300 journalists. So, really, that event, as tragic as it was that what happened with the offensive in El Salvador and the great horror, the numbers of killings and people displaced from homes and communities, I suspect that not only for us in Canada, but for the situation in the U.S. and in Europe as well, that really helped the message get out. And Canadians have been much more aware than I would have anticipated otherwise. And the interest has been very high. And so I've been responding to speaking invitations throughout the last year in Canada. This is really the first time I've had the opportunity to address a group in the U.S. So I'm interested in finding out from you what you've been hearing and what you sense the level of awareness to be around El Salvador, among the general public, but within the church as well, and within particularly the Lutheran Church. I know Mavis and Phil Anderson have been here at Holden Village earlier this summer, and I think Bill Dexheimer was here earlier, or has been various summers. And Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, I think, was here earlier this summer too. And I see there's a big display on Bishop Gomez and his, the need for assistance with him and the church there. So I know that Holden Village is not exactly representative of the U.S. population, of the U.S. church population, but you might have a sense of that too that can be helpful. Throughout this week, I want to just vary the presentation a bit. I'll be using a few slides each night and doing some singing, and hopefully get used to doing some singing as well, sharing some stories, getting your reflections, talking some about what the situation in El Salvador means for our own situation, how we can help to change or to end the crisis in El Salvador, but also what it means for us to be Christian and what it means for us to be the church in the U.S. and in Canada. And that's been really one of the focuses of my message across Canada, is how we can be a more credible group within society as we address the issues that need to be addressed in the light of the good news of liberation. Let's take some time. I want to hear from some of you how many of you have been to El Salvador or Central America, Latin America? Any third world country, or two-thirds world, or where we find. Okay. And then also for those of you who have not had the opportunity to go, what kinds of involvement, how many of you have worked with Salvadoran refugees or immigrants here in North America? Okay. Or from other countries? Okay. So I'd be interested in hearing some of your journey, your stories, how you came to be involved and what it's meant for you.
Holden is the reason I ended up going to El Salvador, because Jack and Sarah Nelson Pallmeyer were here in 87, so December of 87 I went to El Salvador. And there were three Canadians who joined our trip with Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, one of whom came back and I think was injured there. Do you know who that is? Someone who was injured up in
Evan North? Fox Decent?
Yes.
From Winnipeg?
He was with the group that I went with, yeah. And I guess anyone who goes on center trips, I think they're real life-changing. I think it continued to be life-changing because of what happened in November, because we met Martin Barrow when we were there, and then he was one of the Jesuits that was killed. And we met Jim Barnett, and we live in Duluth, Minnesota, and he came up after he left El Salvador. He was a Roman Catholic priest who was with me and had to leave also. But I think that the strongest message, and some people may have heard this before, is I think you have a sense when you're there of meeting modern day martyrs. And I think it's a whole different vision of faith that just changes your life, I guess. And then especially when something happens like happened to the Jesuit priest and you've met those people, and I've used that phrase before, modern day martyrs, in the talks I've given, and then, I mean, indeed it was true. And so I don't think you're ever quite the same again, because you've seen what faith does in extremity, and if there's just tremendous respect for those people, but also a sense of the strength of the faith that's available.
Who's next?
Could you give us just a brief statement on how conditions are there at the moment? You know, it's hard to decipher out of the press reports, here in the States. It's very difficult to know what the truth really is.
I haven't heard a thing. It seems like ever since that aggression, you know, the offensive and whatever, it seems like they haven't said a thing.
Okay, well, over, well, since April, April was the point at which both sides agreed to a series of negotiations mediated by the United Nations, by Javier Perez de Cuellar, the Secretary General. And that's been on again, off again kind of thing. They've been meeting at various points. And the latest on that, last week, I heard that those negotiations had fallen apart. And also I heard that 60 political prisoners had disappeared from Mariona, the prison in just out of San Salvador. And nobody really knows how that happened or why or where they've gone. And I'm not aware of that ever happening before, that political prisoners disappeared from the jail. So, I mean, throughout the summer there have been some hopeful sense about the negotiations that could in fact lead to a ceasefire. And then on the other hand, there have been rumors that there will be another offensive, a major and even perhaps larger offensive. And at this point, that rumor seems to have more credibility in light of what happened last week. I was talking with a Lutheran woman in Washington. I forget her name now. Laura, is it? Works with the Washington Office on Lutheran Affairs. She's a major advocate for policy change with respect to El Salvador, or Central America generally. So I talked with her in late June, and her sense was that finally there was a significant shift in the level of awareness or concern on the part of congresspersons and senators that she felt optimistic would lead to a change in, or a reduction in military aid, U.S. military aid to El Salvador. Which I'd heard, you know, at different points throughout the last years, but she felt at this point that there was more credibility to that. And that's always what Bishop Gomez and the other Lutherans and people throughout the country of El Salvador are asking us to ensure might happen, is that military aid will be cut. And others of you may have more updates too. The information I get is sketchy also. Anyone else wanting to share their personal journey?
Can I ask you a question? Now, what are you doing to disseminate information to other denominations, such as the Baptist, Presbyterian, the general denominations? Are you doing, this media to the churches, or how is that being handled?
Okay, well, the media stuff is public. I mean, that's
Whole population. Out of your activity, though, any direct mailings?
Yeah, my mailings go out to people and representatives of all the churches. The media stuff is general public stuff, you know, whether it's TV, radio, newspaper, whatever. And there are many invitations to speak at other churches, and political events or community events, school events, universities, whatever. Including many, different kinds of church convention type things in other denominations.
You have the funds, for example, if you were invited to Kansas City, do you have the funds to finance that, or would that have to be financed in the local church, or how are you set up that kind of program?
Most of my traveling, my touring and speaking has been financed by the Division for World Mission of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. But they encourage people or groups inviting me to pay the expenses also. And they spent to Kansas, I presume that they would appreciate some assistance with the travel costs. Well, I'll show a few, not all of the slides, but a few of the slides. And the focus today is on passion for truth. And I think more than anything, that's what intrigued me or drew me to El Salvador. I felt that I, as a Canadian, and other Canadians, just weren't getting good information or a good sense about what was happening in El Salvador or other countries for that matter. And partly because, well, I don't entirely blame media for that. I don't think it's media's role to give us the full picture. I mean, they produce what sells. That's their job. As committed as they are to truth and accuracy and so on, and that commitment may vary, or does vary drastically. But I think it's our responsibility to understand the history and the context of a situation. And I think the church is much better equipped to provide that for people than the media. And so I felt that as a Christian, as a pastor working in El Salvador, I could offer that to the church. And particularly the role of the church in a situation like that. The media doesn't often pick up on that. Although with the murders of Jesuit priests and so on, the role of the church becomes more evident. But I think our best sources of information are generally Christians, committed church workers in these settings. And so it just becomes a matter of communication, sharing of information, sharing of stories from these people to our own people. And so I felt that my role and my calling was really out of a passion for truth, for sharing the reality, the story, and that includes the history, the context, the fuller picture. El Salvador is along the Pacific Rim, which makes it a volcanic region. There are some active volcanoes like this one in Nicaragua. This one has a really long history, a legendary folkloric tradition behind it, which says that every time it erupts, there are evil spirits which escape from the inferno inside the earth, and they come out to torment the people of the land. 500 years ago, when the Spaniards came with the Roman Catholic influence to counteract the effects of those evil spirits, they decided they would erect a wooden cross at the rim of the volcano. And they felt that with the presence of this cross, then the people would be protected from these evil spirits. It's become evident that the simple presence, the simple structure of a wooden cross at the rim of the volcano is not adequate to contain all of that evil inside the earth. Evil is very evident in many forms throughout Latin America. And the cross, instead of being a wooden structure at the rim of a volcano, is very much a part of the daily lives of the people, especially the peasants, the campesinos, were made to bear the burden of that cross. The cross is very much a daily part of the lives of the people, the cross of the graveyard. Particularly, most every family in El Salvador has experienced the untimely death of some members of the family, perhaps due to malnutrition, starvation, disease, or other types of exploitation. Just the effects of the war. Many, 75,000 have died because of the war. Thousands died in the earthquake. So the cross of the graveyard is very much a reality with the untimely deaths of so many people. El Salvador is a lush land. It's very tiny. It's about, I guess, the size of Massachusetts. It supports a population of 5.5 million people. And in fact, it could, with its rich volcanic soil, it could grow enough food for that population. if the land were used for food crops, like the corn, or the traditional life symbol of Latin America, or the beans or the rice. But the land has been largely expropriated and it's used for growing export crops, like coffee. There's a major celebration that will be shared by people around the globe. Plans are already well underway for the celebration. Will be the celebration of the 500th anniversary of supposed or so-called discovery of America by Christopher Columbus. For 300 years, the Spaniards dominated Latin America, Portugal and Brazil and so on, but primarily Spain dominated Latin America. Then there was a move to win independence from Spain. 1821, the region of Central America gained independence, and this monument was erected to celebrate that independence. But it's an independence celebrated by a very few of the population, because it, while it meant independence for the business class, the wealthy, the effects on the poorer have been only made worse. And the effects for them have been displacement from their farmlands, many into many as exiles into refugee camps like these in Honduras. Over the last decade or two, there are just over a million people, a million Salvadorans who've had to flee the country. Many of those are in the U.S. We have, I think, about 50,000 in Canada, many in Mexico and other Latin Central American countries. About 500,000 also had to flee into places of refuge in the city of San Salvador, into say the courtyard of this basilica, Sacred Heart Basilica in downtown San Salvador. We visited here in 85, and there were about 400 or 500 people sheltered in this courtyard. This woman had just recently arrived, and she told us the story of her flight from her village. They'd been bombed out of their village, and on route during their flight, they had been hidden in culverts where they'd been chased out by the army dogs, and they'd also been bombed with chemical bombs, white phosphorus, and so on. And the eyes of her child here are still quite burnt. And she told of the torture of her family along the way. Her oldest son had been tortured. She, in fact, had been forced to participate and was forced to pull out his internal organs by hand. And then she had watched him die. Yet she came to this place very grateful for the protection of the church, thankful that God had brought her and some of her family to this place alive, and also spoke of Oscar Romero, who had been killed, the archbishop, who had been assassinated 5 years earlier, as her model for truth, or for hope and faith. And so we watched as these people were rebuilding their lives, their community here in this courtyard. It was rather uncomfortable for us. We felt as though we were in a zoo watching caged animals because of the conditions in which they lived. And yet they assured us that they wanted us there. They wanted us to take their pictures. They wanted us to hear their stories and understand their reality and their hope for change. And especially they wanted us to share their stories with our own people so that we could help them in their struggle for freedom and justice. And there are other places of refuge. This one also run by the Roman Catholic Church called Calle Real, just north of town, so there was a little more spacious. And they were trying to be self-sufficient as much as possible, with clothing and furniture and so on. In the former camp, most of the citizens there were without ID, so they couldn't even leave the buildings. They were there for 4 or 5 years, almost as prisoners. And here at this place, there was much military harassment, so eventually the place shut down. In 1982, there was a request that came from the Red Cross, actually, to the Lutheran Church to assist with the settlement of displaced people. And the response of the church was to purchase this land. There was some land reform happening at the time, so there was land available for purchase, and the church built Fe y Esperanza, Faith and Hope, and sheltered several hundred displaced people for, over the next few years. This was really the church's initiation into the societal problems facing El Salvador, and from there they've mushroomed in their response to the plight of their citizens. Here there was some space for keeping of rabbits and chickens and some gardening and some crop, growing of crops, a set of workshops of various kinds, for weaving, for sewing, for shoemaking, for carpentry, for set up a school as well, which serves also the community, and a clinic. About 87, 5 years after it opened, many of the people moved on to Panchimilama, where there would be more space for agriculture and self-sufficiency. Some of the seniors especially stayed behind and set Fe y Esperanza up as an orphanage for somewhat over 100 children and students, youth. So that during the time I was there, I was serving as pastor and administrator of this orphanage. And we had space to grow all of the corn and beans that we needed to support the community. Other supplies are purchased in San Salvador and delivered, especially from donations from Europe and North America. This is one of the festival days. Actually, this was the anniversary of Fe y Esperanza, the 7th anniversary. People in El Salvador love to celebrate, and they'll arrange these huge events several times a year. Each of the communities will invite people from all over the country. And the youth at Fe were no exception. They would give themselves a couple of weeks to plan a major event and distribute invitations all over the country. Plan the day. The morning would be spent in worship, a very lively participatory worship. They plan lunch for hundreds of guests and transportation also for people to get there. And then the afternoon would be the cultural event. So they invite a lot of participation with the singing and the dancing, the drama, and they put their own sociodrama together too and tell the story of their own lives throughout the decade. And I have a song which I'd like to sing, and it's a ballad, it tells the story of the children of Fe. It's called Seeds of Hope. Thank you. passion for truth fills these children, fills the people of the church, and it's that passion for truth which is so threatening to the authorities, to people in the army, to people in the government, to people among the wealthy, to the oligarchy. And so even an orphanage is the subject of attack, the object of attack. And this was a bombing that took place in August of 87 against Faye Esperanza. This was the fairly newly constructed kindergarten and nursery. And fortunately, no one was yet living or staying in this building, and so no one was injured. And it has since been reconstructed. I spent a day helping with the cleanup. I was there visiting at the time, and also sat in on a press conference with Bishop Medardo Gomez, and he explained to the journalists, he was careful about not specifically accusing anyone or any group, but he said it was the responsibility of forces in the country who were not willing to see peace come to El Salvador. So passion for truth in El Salvador is subversive, and it does lead to martyrdom. I'm sure you're all aware of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who in the late 70s became the leading voice for truth in El Salvador, and he was fully aware too that being a voice for truth, a voice for the people who really were voiceless, would lead to his martyrdom. He received many death threats, and he spoke of his imminent assassination by saying that people might be able to kill him, but they could not silence his voice, they could not kill his spirit. As a believer in the resurrection, he knew that he would rise again and again in the spirits of the people. And over the 10 years since his assassination, that has become very evident. So this is the Metropolitan Cathedral from which he preached weekly homilies, naming the evils of the society, and specifically naming the atrocities happening to his people, the stories that he heard from week to week, and which were broadcast over public radio each Sunday. And so as a voice for truth, he was a target, and his tomb now is in the transept of that cathedral with plaques of gratitude from many communities and parishes. A tapestry hangs beside his tomb, quoting John 1:5, "The light shone in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it." And he encouraged people to organize themselves, to be a stronger voice for truth, and a stronger call for peace and justice. And so people, well, already in the 70s were doing that, and that has continued throughout the 80s. This is the UNTS, an umbrella organization of union workers, comprises about 500,000, about 10% of the population of El Salvador. This is one of the mothers' committees. There are several who work together in a network, but keep separate offices for protection of themselves and their files, because they are frequently attacked and bombed as well. And these women are brought together in the common search for missing relatives. And so they produce artisan products, sell them, raise funds for the newspaper campaigns. And they also express the truth in the streets as they march for peace and justice. They're preparing one of the banners for such a march. Even during the state of siege following the offensive of November, they were some of the first people out in the streets, in spite of it being very illegal at that point to be marching in the streets. They felt they had little to lose. This was one of the many bombings happening just before the offensive against one of the offices of the Mothers Committee. Another against the Finastras Union office, which killed 10 and injured about 30 just in the days prior to the offensive, was seen as the final provocation for the offensive, which was named after one of the women union leaders killed, Fabi Velasquez. And there are human rights organizations throughout the country too, which are committed to working for peace or for truth. And so they'll investigate violations of human rights and assassinations and disappearances. They'll document those, publicize those. And each of the churches has their own human rights department, including the Lutheran Church, with a group of human rights lawyers. Salvadorans are very aware that the war is not only fought with bullets and bombs. The war is very evident in El Salvador in that way, but they're very much aware that really it's a war for truth. And that war is being fought outside of El Salvador as much as within the country. And so they're very, very conscious about bringing their witness and their testimony, their voice for truth, to other parts of the world. This is a woman from the Mothers Committee who was traveling across Canada, sharing her story, wearing the typical white, the dress that they use in their marches, the white representing peace, the black of mourning, and the red as the blood of her relatives. So she's being interviewed by Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. This was in our church in Calgary. And meeting with Salvadoran friends, refugees in Calgary. Often words prove inadequate to share the reality, the passion of their truth. And so Salvadorans are very passionate in their use of the arts. And this mime group in Calgary is expressing their truth through a different medium. As are these children, Salvadoran refugees in Nicaragua, sharing their poetry and their songs. And they often sing about Oscar Romero also as their model for truth and life and justice and faith and hope, even though most of them are too young to remember him in real life. And attacks against the university, the truth of that comes from students also is a threat. This is a student's depiction of life on campus from the time when Duarte was president, still manipulated by the puppet strings. And sometimes the truth, the anguish, the agony spills out on the walls. And this is throughout the city of San Salvador. With so many military around, I felt awkward about taking pictures on city streets, but even in rural areas, the anguish graffiti is found frequently. Okay, we'll save these slides for later. Just a few minutes to wrap up, if any of you want to join us again with sharing your...
My wife and I went to Central America with the Center for Global Education. We spent about 2 weeks there in Mexico, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. And I guess we came back with a fair amount of zeal to try to speak and change people's minds. And I think one of the things that that we really experienced was that I'm not sure we changed anybody's mind who hadn't seen it themselves. I think one of the things that was the most discouraging to us was that even though we have a fair amount of credibility in our community, and people didn't really think we were crazy, I think they probably thought that that the difference between what we were saying and what they had understood from the media and from our government officials was so different that we must have been somehow brainwashed. And the most frustrating thing is, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but the most frustrating thing here is that people really can't believe that the U.S. Is wrong, and that if you give anybody that message, they don't believe it. I think the most powerful, I think one of the most powerful things, as you said, was if the church, particularly I think the things that have been published in our Lutheran magazine, if Bishop Gomez says something and it's published in the Lutheran, I think it has a lot more credibility among Lutherans than if George Bush says it, or if we say it. And we need more, I think we need more of that from from the power structure within the church.
Still, you get a lot of people in the church that say, we don't want to hear anything political. Let's stick to religion. You know? My father went to Nicaragua, and he, this was his first experience with anything like that, and he's a pastor, and he tried to, you know, he couldn't help but have some stories or something about Nicaragua in some of his sermons, and many people in his congregation said, no politics from the pulpit.
We had Jim Barnett in our church, and somebody said the same thing. He spoke at one of our adult forums, and he just turned around and pointed out the American flag in our church.
Yeah.
He said, don't tell me you're not political. That was the end of that one.
I'll just close with a brief anecdote. I was recently flying back into Calgary, which is kind of my home base, and sitting beside a man from Chicago, who was a business person working, I don't know, with a chain of clothing stores, I guess, and we were chatting. I was telling him about what I was doing and a little about El Salvador, and evidently he wasn't too aware or too interested about El Salvador, but he figured if there was any repression of the churches in El Salvador, then it must have to be a communist government. So, in terms of sharing truth, we have quite a lot of work to do. And if he could suppose that the Christianity government in El Salvador is communist. But certainly there is a lot of understanding. So hopefully this week can be a kind of a time of generating each other's passion for truth, and both in this place and wherever we go from this place. Thank you for your interest, and hope to see you back tomorrow and the days following.
Thank you.